From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a program that provides long-term care for adults could be eliminated in the proposed state budget. Later, Rob Graziano shares why he thinks Wisconsin rocks, or what he thinks about Wisconsin rocks, anyway.
It was really in my third year of schooling at UWM that I found the passion, and it was some professors that inspired me, and I thought, this is pretty exciting. Get to work out in the field and study rocks and do something relevant with them.
Plus, what an award-winning chef owes to the work of a Frenchman more than a century ago.
I love this style of cooking. It's very classic. I base my cooking on the classics. I never tried to modernize everything that I do or that I want to be capable of doing in the kitchen. So this, for me, is a tribute to something that I'm very fond of.
And a food lover's guide to the city we call home. Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Battle lines are being drawn over portions of Governor Walker's proposed budget for the coming 2 years. A lot of attention has been paid to its potential impact on higher and K-12 education and state parks. But there are many other programs that are not known as well, but stand to be dramatically shaped by the measure. One is a program called IRIS, which serves adults with long-term care needs. It's administered by the state's Department of Health Services, but would be eliminated under the current version of the budget bill. And despite assurances that care for these adults would continue, the elimination of IRIS worries some people. It spurred the creation of a grassroots group called Save IRIS. Among its members are Julie Burrish of Brookfield, whose 19-year-old daughter has Down syndrome, and Nancy Gapinski of Glendale, who has an autistic son who is not yet old enough to be served by IRIS. Burrish and Gapinski join us in the studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So excited to be here.
Let's start with some definitions here. What is IRIS set up to accomplish, and why is it important to you that it's structured the way it is?
Well, IRIS is, well, for one, it's an acronym, and it stands for Include, Respect, I Self-Direct. And it's really based on a social model that people with disabilities and older people that are frail, end of life, that they can determine exactly the supports they need and hire people that they feel are safe and stable and that they feel comfortable with, because a lot of the care they get is very intimate in nature, and they often have to allow people into their homes and into just private settings. And it's really based on integrating them into the community too.
Well, and is this similar in a way to the dynamic about everything that has to do with healthcare? There's always a lot of concern about if change takes place, will people be able to access the people, you know, whether it's their own primary care provider or in this case the people that help them on a day-to-day basis?
Yes, that's one of our big concerns about all this. Recently, with the governor's budget coming out, there's more questions than there are answers. It eliminates the IRIS program, which we value greatly, and it also is making major changes to the family care program, which is the managed care model for community integration through the Medicaid waiver programs. So we are very worried because we don't know if people will have access to the doctors that they're used to or if they'll be able to still hire the people that they currently employ. We're concerned about our friends who are up in the rural areas who don't have as many providers to choose from. And so having neighbors to employ has made a huge difference for them in terms of being able to have consistent care.
So if I understand what you're saying correctly, the services provided by IRIS would be folded in under family care, but the question remains whether family care would provide them in the same way, and the answers either aren't known yet or they certainly haven't been disseminated to the degree that you're able to know for sure.
That's exactly correct. IRIS would be eliminated and people would be moved into family care, but family care is going to fundamentally change, and it's going to, according to what is proposed, it looks like it's going to actually become an insurance, an HMO, and it will be managed by probably a very large national HMO, and will do away with the 8 managed care organizations that are nonprofit that currently provide the services. And we have no idea what is going to be entailed it's a medical model, and that isn't really always what's appropriate when you're dealing with people with cognitive disabilities, especially because they're not sick. They just need support to be productive and to live their lives.
Has IRIS always worked well for you?
Yeah, it's a work in progress. You know, originally when it started, they only expected it to really have a few 100 people, maybe up to 1,000 people. And people are finding that self-direction really provides them with so much freedom to get what they want, when they need it. And, you know, a lot of difficult life choices, like transportation is very difficult. But boy, if you can hire a neighbor to drive you to work, that's so much easier than dealing with a transportation company. And yes, people are finding that it's much more cost effective and that you get exactly what you need when you need it. And it helps me create the life that I want for my daughter and that she gets to create the life that she wants for herself.
It's a unique model that really gives the person more control over their own lives. And we just don't see how that would fit under a managed care umbrella of a giant HMO.
Well, I guess the reason I ask is, you know, people might think that, hey, this is a large-scale program and there are probably some inefficiencies. And one thing that sometimes happens when HMOs come in is that they do away with redundancies and things sometimes work better. But you say you don't really have the answers to know whether it would work better.
Well, this has been a work in progress. Family Care and IRIS have been a community, kind of a coalition. The stakeholders have been brought to the table. We've been developing this plan. It started out as pilots, and as the pilots became successful, they expanded to – that's why it's not in every county yet. We're expecting a big expansion into the 7 Northeast counties because it works. It saves money. Just expanding to these 7 new counties is going to save $14 million in the first year because it's so much more effective than working just through the Medicaid system. And that's what's so hard about this decision is that it seems like it's been made. It seems like nobody knew about it. The stakeholders weren't involved. Even Kitty Rhodes, who is the secretary of the Department of Health Services, said in her journal article that she didn't know about it until the proposed budget came out, and that was a month ago. But yet, there's been lots of conversations about what the new plan is going to be, and I just would like to know who's been having those conversations and what are the conversations. And to tell you that the people who are involved and who have always been at the table weren't at the table for those. And that's what I find as a mother so distressing, that this is a plan that I've been using to – my daughter's 19, so we're new to it. But we're working on a 5-year plan for her. And we're working on what do we – our 5-year goal is for her to live independently. And we're breaking it up into small pieces. What do we need to accomplish this year so that she can build on that next year? So eventually, in 5 years, she's going to be able to live independently in the community, work full-time, have a rich life, just like anyone else. But she's always, because of her cognitive disabilities, always going to need some long-term support. And I want to be the one working with her to coordinate that. And I don't charge for my services. All my case management is completely free. And that's the one thing with IRIS is when you hire people that you know, you get so much more than what you pay for because these people have relationships with the person they're taking care of. And you get a higher level of care at a much lower rate, and you get a lot of unpaid natural support.
What are you hearing from lawmakers, if anything?
This has really taken, I think, a lot of people by shock, including legislators, I believe. We've been calling legislators, and they don't seem to know yet either what the details of the plan would be. And so they're not able to give us the answers that we need to feel reassured that the services that people have now are going to be there the way they have them now.
And the thing that I'm really hoping, because, you know, like I said, Nancy and I, and we've started this grassroots effort, and we have a Facebook page, and we have a website. And, I mean, we just started this because we found out about it. We have a group of friends, you know, that we Facebook, and we put it out there, and we've grown. We have our Save IRIS Facebook page and our SaveIRIS.org website. And on our Facebook page, we have 3,000 people following us. Over 800 people have taken surveys. People are shocked. People don't know why this is happening or you know, what's going on.
And they're scared. They don't know what to expect. And so the response, like with the surveys, we're hearing from people who have maybe a son or daughter who is nonverbal and they've been self-injurious in the past. And they've got supports in place now that are so consistent and with people that they know so well and trust that incidents of self-injury have gone down. We're hearing from people who are caring for frail elders and they're finding that the supports that they can put in place have made it so they can continue to work and they haven't lost their homes. So those types of stories we're just hearing again and again. So we're nervous.
Yeah, and people want choice. They want to take care of their loved ones. They want their loved ones to be cared for in a way that integrates them into the community, that people they know and love or care about or feel safe with are caring for them. And, you know, when you work for one, changing to from a social model to a medical model, it one assumes the person is sick, you know, and then two, for example, if I need transportation or if Catherine, my daughter, needs transportation, you know, I would have to call in and get it approved and I'd say, okay, we need these number of trips. We don't know who's going to show up, you know, so she could have a different person every time. And these are vulnerable people. Do I feel comfortable having her just, you know, get on board with somebody she doesn't know? I feel much more comfortable knowing that somebody that knows her is going to be transporting her or providing very intimate care. And it's cost effective. That's the thing. There is in this whole plan, this proposal, this budget proposal, there is absolutely no cost savings laid out. I don't understand why this is happening. And as far as the legislators go, they're surprised. But I'm hoping that this doesn't become a politicized thing, that all of a sudden it's going to be, you know, just down party lines, that because we have this is the governor, that everybody, you know, in his party is going to go with this change. But what we're hearing is that senators and assembly people on both sides are very concerned. Very concerned, and they know this is a good program and that it works and it's cost effective. It saves the state money.
One of the reasons that it's cost effective is people truly are just getting the supports that they actually need. In other models, sometimes there's that layer of case management and nursing, and with IRIS, that isn't there. And they are getting, in essence, free case management from loved ones. And so we're kind of wondering, why wouldn't we want to expand upon that? We feel like IRIS should be celebrated, not eliminated.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like as the debate over this is going to go on that everything that you do as far as IRIS goes is going to be under a microscope?
I do. I think it kind of is. And I know that there is some positioning going on. And I know that right now what's coming up, people don't completely understand. Right now, there's everything in the media says that people are given a certain dollar amount every month. And I think that people conjure that, okay, these people in IRIS get a check every month for X amount of dollars to take care of their needs. And that's so not what happens. I think that there are some people that think that there's a lot of fraud that goes on. And actually, all the research I've done shows that the level of fraud in IRIS is lower than any other long-term care support program out there. But what happens is we do have case management. We have an IRIS consultant who helps us come up with a plan, and the plan is based on the person's abilities and moving them into the most independence as possible. Everything has to be approved. There is not one penny that can come out of that budget or a check that can be written that isn't completely approved, and I have no authority over the budget. And if we want to do something different, we have to go through quite a lengthy process to change the plan. So it's very well regulated. And the whole thing that that's one of the misconceptions is I think people think that, you know, this is just a program where people get a check and they can do whatever they want to. And it's so far from the truth.
Now, Julie, you mentioned the 5-year plan mm-hmm. that you are putting together with your daughter, and one of those areas that you were talking about is her ability to hold down a full-time job. Where does work fit in what IRIS does?
Well, what IRIS does is it provides long-term supports, and should she need support at work, we can be very, very creative with writing into her plan supports at work, whether that means something that she needs to support all the time or a couple times a month someone needs to check into. I mean, IRIS is able to provide support so people can be as independent at work as possible. And that just fits in so well with the governor's Better Bottom Line, which was such a wonderful initiative. And it is. And I just see that growing. And through IRIS and integrated employment, people with disabilities can become such productive taxpayers and citizens.
Well, now, you mentioned you've not really necessarily heard any consistent message from lawmakers at this point. What do you hope comes out of this? Is it simply to reject that part of the budget?
Ideally, they would just leave family care and IRIS alone and continue to let them be and do the good work that they're doing. But that being said, if we just feel like it should not be in the budget at all. It's so significant for so many people. There's going to be massive job loss. People are very worried. They don't know what their supports are going to look like. It should not be in the budget.
Yeah, we're asking – our ask is to please remove the changes to long-term care from this budget, bring the stakeholders to the table, and let us help determine what changes are made. That's just critical.
Julie Burrish. Nancy Gapinski, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Nancy Gapinski of Glendale and Julie Burrish of Brookfield are members of a group called Save IRIS, a state-supported long-term care program for adults that would be eliminated as part of the governor's proposed state budget for the coming biennium. We'll take a break now and then get some rock-solid information about what's under Wisconsin's soil, rocks, that is. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. In case you hadn't noticed it for the past few months, there are things like grass and pavement under what until recently were persistent piles of Wisconsin snow. But underneath all of it, formed over hundreds of millions of years, are rocks. Lots of rocks, all different kinds, which are maybe more interesting than you might have thought. Rob Graziano already thinks they're interesting. He's an instructor and an instructional lab manager in the Department of Geosciences at UW-Milwaukee. He's the man behind a series of science bag lectures ongoing this month, and he joined Bonnie North in the studio for a primer on our rocks, which include igneous, sedimentary, and...
That's metamorphic rocks. Any rock can become a metamorphic rock. It's a rock that's been subjected to heat and pressure. So you're changing it into something else. You're metamorphosing it into something else.
Okay. What got you interested in geology, and why are rocks fascinating to you?
Well, I'd like to say, you know, sometimes kids collect a lot of rocks and they say they're destined to be maybe a geologist, but that wasn't me. I didn't have that fascination. It was really in my third year of schooling at UWM that I found the passion, and it was some professors that inspired me, and I thought, this is pretty exciting. Get to work out in the field and study rocks and do something relevant with them.
So what do you do? What is your research, and how are you advancing geological knowledge?
My background is in environmental geology, hydrogeology, and a little bit of geotechnical. I worked in environmental consulting for 12, 13 years. And now back in academia, my goal is geoscience education. So I teach in 100-level courses, and I coordinate our outreach for our department. So I work with middle school, high school, all ages. And it's really just – it's my passion, so I'm very enthusiastic about sharing my passion for geology.
One of the things I think people – a term people are familiar with is geothermal. But some of the other ways that geology could be environmentally, you know, how does that all fit? What kinds of things are you teaching your students?
Well, geology, for example, the course I'm teaching right now, environmental geology, it's one of those courses that I think can relate to just any person, whether you're in political science major, economics major, any sort of humanities, music, no matter what. You can relate to it because you're using resources from the earth, and then we're impacting the earth. So I try and relate as much as I can to the layman's audience and say, why would you need to know what type of rock this is? It's not so much about the type of rock it is, but it's the fact that we're using those resources, and if we use too many of them, we're going to run out of them.
And I would also assume if we're building places and there's certain kinds of rock, you need to know that as well.
Absolutely. A foundation stone is very important. So, in fact, for example, downtown Milwaukee, some of the foundations here go down through the clay material and they sit on bedrock, and we have to drive pilings. For example, the new Northwestern building, you can see the excavation that's going on there. It's significant because it's not very easy to put up something on what was formerly a lake bed.
What makes Wisconsin in particular such an interesting place for a geologist? Is there something unique here that we don't see maybe in the other Great Lakes states, or are we sort of part of that bigger geological picture?
We're part of that. Some people say Wisconsin's a little bit geologically boring, but I wouldn't say that because we have igneous metamorphic sedimentary rocks. We have some Precambrian rocks in northern part of the state that go up to about 2.8 billion years old. And here in southeast Wisconsin, we have what we call Silurian age rocks that are about 400 million years old, and they represent us having been in a location where there was a shallow sea at some time in the geologic past. And that's sometimes hard for people to grasp. But just that explanation of the time and the type of rocks that we have really, I think, excites people, and that's what I like to share with them.
One of the things that I think geology is so good for is explaining history in a way that you don't think about in other ways. You know, you're talking about, you know, 400 million years old, 1.2 billion, you know, it's like, wow. I mean, the scale is so huge.
Exactly. That's one of the hardest concepts in teaching geology is the scale of geologic time. Because if you were to represent, I just did this for a program that we're doing, someone's lifetime, say 100 years, and you compare that and put that in a scale of 1 year. If you said the Earth was 1 year old, what would one person's lifetime be? It would be, I think it's 7/100ths of a second compared to the age of the Earth. So it's hard for us to grasp the time involved to build mountains and the time involved to erode mountains and to see the structures that we see here.
And at the same time, that's all continuing to change and evolve as well. I mean, the time is very slow to us, how long it takes to build mountains or that. But my understanding is that so much is happening under the Earth's crust. What's, you know, that it's not static.
Exactly. It's in our lifetime, we see things that might happen in days or weeks. Right now, there's a volcano going off in Chile right now. So we can see images in the news of that. And that's very relevant. And yes, it's forming rocks currently because this magma is coming out and it's ejecting and cooling right away and forming volcanic rocks that form almost instantly. But there's rocks that are forming at depth that might take weeks, months, days, years, thousands of years to cool and form. And then it's also, once we have this volcano there, it takes thousands of years to erode it. You can see things in real terms, but it's also hard to put that into geologic time and think about that mountain. It's going to take thousands of years to erode.
Right. So you've got the immediate and then the really long view.
Exactly.
Yeah. So when you do these wonderful Wisconsin rocks demonstrations, who are you talking to and what are you trying to get across to them?
Well, in the feature, the Wisconsin Rocks Science Bag that we're doing, we're trying to reach all audiences. We have something for, obviously, for the children because we have demos that we involve audience members, and they're always the most enthusiastic to raise their hand and come up there and volunteer. But really, the audiences are for all ages because I have some stuff about the geology of Wisconsin and the history of in terms of plate tectonics and geologic history of the state that adults are kind of fascinated. Maybe they've never had a geology course before. And then I have a part of the program that really deals with rock uses. So how we look at a granite that might have formed in what is now Wausau 1.8 billion years ago. But now it's shaped into a memorial that's down on the lakefront in the Veterans Memorial. So there's red granite right here in Milwaukee. And hopefully people recognize some of these rocks and maybe have a little bit more appreciation for them. That's kind of the goal of it.
You talked about plate tectonics, and of course, we tend to think of California as a very active place for that. Does Wisconsin have an active tectonics, or is it pretty stable at this point?
No, Wisconsin is considered in the middle of the North American Craton, so a stable part of the country. So if you look at a plate tectonic map, you'd say, no, we're not even near a plate boundary. So our risk for earthquakes and volcanoes is really nil right now. But in the geologic past, there was a breading center in northern Wisconsin, and that's why we have basaltic rocks up in northern part of Wisconsin, because in the geologic past, there had been a spreading center, and it actually ceased to continue spreading in what we call it a failed rift zone. But it did allow basaltic magma to flow out and solidify, and that's why we have basalts up there.
See, this is why I should have gone back to school. So what do you hope people take away from your talks and also from your classes, but also in these public talks? I mean, what are you trying to get people to realize about geology?
Well, from the talks, it's just, you know, the Science Bag program is a very enthusiastic look at geology of Wisconsin and the rocks. And in that sense, I'm hoping people just get an appreciation for the rocks. And you know, when you see a granite countertop, you might consider, well, that came from somewhere and it took a lot of effort to get it here, to carve it and to polish it and get it in place. But it took a lot of effort for it to become formed in the first place. It might be 1.8 billion years old. But in the bigger picture, I'm hoping people get an understanding of the importance of geology in everyday life, because there's a lot of things in geology, especially regarding mineral resources, energy resources, that are important to everyone. Literally just the gas prices that we watch right now have to do with how much fuel we're producing and the fact that we're relying on fossil fuels. And those fossil fuels are limited. So things like that, I think people can relate to in everyday life.
Well, Rob Graziano, I want to thank you very much for stopping by and talking with us, and best of luck with Wisconsin Rocks.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited for it.
Rob Graziano is something of a rock star. He is an instructor and instructional lab manager in the Department of Geosciences at UW-Milwaukee. His Science Bag series on rocks continues this Sunday at 2 o'clock in the UWM Physics Building. He spoke with Bonnie North. From a literal rock star to a figurative rock star in the world of cooking, Adam Siegel of Lake Park Bistro joins Kyle Cherik to honor the legacy of Auguste Escoffier. Who is that, you might ask? Keep listening and find out on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Solid. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Back when I was in seventh grade, my first year French class took a field trip to have a fancy French meal, the kind with many courses immaculately prepared and presented. It was an intimidating but truly rewarding experience, full of French that was, I'm sure, butchered by a bunch of 12-year-olds. Even for adults, though, the fine French meal is often a night out that people aspire to, many steps above that impulsive trip out to Applebee's or even the night on the town at the brew pub. It turns out that much of what we think of as the fine French meal can trace its history back to a single source, Auguste Escoffier. His legacy is also at the heart of what's being called the Escoffier Dinner tomorrow evening, a project of Lake Park Bistro chef Adam Siegel and food writer, TV host, and Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik. They spoke with Bonnie North, and Kyle explained the concept.
So we put together a series in partnership with Bartolotta, and this is the fourth dinner, really, within the theme. And we're going to, you know, finish it with the king of chefs, chef of kings, Auguste Escoffier. I mean, when I had the idea, my fiance and I driving home from a great dinner, I knew that the first one that I should pitch Adam would be Escoffier, and the rest he might go
right
along with, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah, hit him in his sweet spot. I mean, he's, I don't even know where to begin with Escoffier, although I better figure it out by the 13th.
Because you have to talk about
it. Yeah, exactly. I mean, he is the singular chef that codified Western cuisine. And
he's the master of French cuisine. Escoffier, you know, was around many years ago, but he modernized it. He made it what it is today. Without him, we wouldn't have the systems or the recipes in place that are with us today.
Every kitchen, basically, that's larger than a hot dog stand through a hotel that would serve 1,800 people or more is set up because of Escoffier's thought process and the paradigm that he put forth.
Okay, so
it's that big
really
of a deal.
He's really the father of modern fancy cooking.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Before him was Antoine Carême, and Marie Antoine Carême. And Escoffier took what he put into place, because Carême was considered the master and really the first popular chef or celebrity chef out there in the early 1800s. And Escoffier basically took off where he left, but then modernized everything that Carême did and also made it more popular and also made it more accessible by creating systems in kitchens to where it would be able to be produced in restaurants on a much easier and larger scale. And then he also made it so that people could understand the recipes and duplicate them.
Many of the pastries that we think of as classic French pastries, Carême put in place. He codified. And he was cooking for the Third Empire, the Third Napoleon. And, you know, he dies in 1833. And by the time he dies at 49, he was on the payroll for the Rothschilds and doing just insane things like poaching sturgeon in champagne and replacing the scales with truffles. I mean, it was this ridiculous, fantastic, high style of cooking and gave us the four original sauces. But Escoffier codified the five mother sauces that every culinary student in their first, like, 6 months.
Okay, so we're talking béarnaise.
Well, it's hollandaise, which, you know, béarnaise comes from. It's béchamel. It's a brown sauce. Then there's the white sauce. And then the tomato sauce, sauce espagnole.
So those are the things that chefs today have to master in order to be
it's the basics, it's the foundations, it's the building blocks of what gets you to everything else. You know, if when you know those and you master those, you're able to move into other areas, to branch off and create something else. That was the thought process.
Now, what are some of the recipes that we might see on a menu today, or some variation on a menu today, that came from this, from Escoffier?
They're really, correct me if I'm wrong, Chef, but they're really iterations. I mean, his style of cooking was much more fancy, and I don't think we'd enjoy it in the same way now. But also technology has come along so far.
Correct.
I mean, when Carême was cooking, it was literally over large fires.
Right.
In kitchens where there'd be two, and then a spit, you know, or they'd be turning an animal 15 feet away. In Escoffier's time, you know, he was in charge of basically setting up the kitchen on ocean liners in the 19-teens. And that technology was just completely unavailable 20 years earlier. So the dishes are predicated by that kind of style of cooking. And now our kitchens are so much more modern. I'd love to know what he would have done with induction. I mean, just I want Escoffier to come back for 4 days, give him an induction and a real sous vide and a few other things and just see what he turns out.
Or even just high-powered gas burners, you know, or a convection oven. You know, his ovens were wood-fired. His stoves were wood-fired for the most part at the beginning of his career. And it's a lot different cooking that way. But some of the things that he would have done is just simply poaching a fish in white wine and then creating a sauce out of that poaching liquid by reducing the wine, adding in some cream, adding in some aromatics, and that would have just been a simple, what we call vin blanc, a white sauce for a fish, and just mastering that and knowing the amounts of everything to put in, what goes with the fish, how to cook the fish properly, to what point you take it out. Those are all the things that he taught in his kitchens.
Okay, so something like a fish poached in white wine, which we see on so many menus, that really kind of started there, that
yeah, I mean, Carême was certainly doing it, but the style of cooking that he was working in, you know, back when he was cooking, oftentimes a dough would go around a meat just to cook it. It wasn't the edible part. You literally threw that away. It was just a flour and water mixture. By the time Escoffier was retiring, the breads and the pastries and the style, the aptitude of the food, I guess, was so much higher and so much more varied. And it's fascinating because Carême was cooking under the employ of royalty all over the world. Russians, well, not Russian czars, but Russian royalty and French royalty and the Rothschilds. And what Escoffier and Irv Ritz did is they basically gave us our sense of luxury. They created the Ritz, first the Savoy, they saved it in London, then they created the Ritz in Paris and then the Carlton back in London, and they put the others out of business. But everybody, I mean everybody, from Oriental potentates to Queen Victoria leaving London to come and have lunch at Escoffier's dining room, came to them. I mean, that's pretty profound for food, right? That's great cooking.
Okay, so Adam, is everyone going to come to you with this dinner that's happening? And so you've got some big shoes to fill there, or big pots maybe.
Yeah. Absolutely. But I love this style of cooking. It's very classic. I base my cooking on the classics. I never tried to modernize everything that I do or that I want to be capable of doing in the kitchen. So this for me is a tribute to something that I'm very fond of and very happy to do. And it's almost natural for me to want to cook in this style. And it is very natural for me to cook in this style. And it's going to be fun to be able to teach it to my cooks, you know, because you don't always cook this way every day on a line in a restaurant. You build things differently so that you can pick it up like an assembly line in a car factory, whereas this is cooking a dish completely from, you know, start to finish and putting it all together the way that they would have.
It's almost a historical nod back because we don't usually eat this way even in restaurants now. I mean, this kind of menu, this kind of process isn't really our modern dining experience.
I mean, I see history and how it – excuse me. I see food history and how it shapes people and shapes culture and then ultimately on the plate. But it was so great to be able to come to Adam and have him be excited and know every chef that cooks in a French style walks in Escoffier's shoes and to say, yeah, let's do this. Let's have the plating. Let's have the glassware. Let's get all the extra things in a kitchen and know that it would be executed beautifully. You know, there's very few restaurants across America that have attempted to recreate one of Escoffier's menus.
This is one of his menus that you're doing.
This is one of his menus. He was very famous for putting together menus as well for occasions. And he put a lot of thought and research into the menus. Typically, he went as far as to making sure that the tablecloth and the napkins matched the food properly. Or, so all the linens, even the – sometimes he would have rooms painted to make sure that everything flowed and that he felt that the mood of everybody was – would be enhanced by not only the food but by all the surroundings.
He was a true restaurateur. I mean, he had arguments with the cruise liner folks about where the dining room would be set for the best view. Because this was – or else he would not take the job.
Right. He was
kind of
thinking,
stuff. Yeah.
He was thinking of this as really an entire experience.
Because absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. And dining should be an entire experience. It's not solely just the food. You could have great food but be in a dungeon and it's not going to taste as good as it would if you were in this beautiful dining room. But also the flow of the menu is very important to him. You know, he didn't want to put super bold flavors – always at the beginning or the end. He wanted to have them, he wanted to build up to something and then, end on a good strong note, but not think too high. He wanted to be able to cleanse the palate at certain points of the meal. He also wanted to make sure that you were able to, your palate was able to taste everything at every course of the menu, that you weren't just overwhelmed at some point and you went palate deaf.
I was going to say everything went sort of stopped because you couldn't take it in anymore.
Correct.
Yeah. All right. So if you go to this, give me some highlights of the types of foods that you would enjoy.
Well, one of the hors d'oeuvres that he was always very famous for was caviar and bellinis. You know, he pretty much perfected making the bellini and putting the right amount of caviar on and having it with the right kind of champagne. Or he started often his menus with a consommé, which is a clarified stock or broth. And this one we're going to be doing is going to be chicken, and it's going to be served with artichokes. He was very famous for using artichokes in a lot of his dishes. We're going to have Dover sole, which we're going to be poaching in white wine. And then we're going to have truffles and crayfish with that. That's followed by venison, which is then followed by a pan-roasted quail with grapes, which is served with a pan sauce, which – you know, he didn't just use the one piece of quail or like a, you know, just the breast. He utilized all of the products. So the bird gets utilized everywhere in the dish. He was known for finishing his entree or his last protein course with a salad because that was the palate cleanser. It wasn't sorbet always or something like that. And then we were going to finish it off with a dessert. And he was known for his frozen desserts, which we call ice cream these days. They call them frozen desserts. And we're going to be doing vanilla and pineapple, which will be good.
And put in perspective that he died in 1935. So the technology, first of all, to get pineapple was extremely exotic. And then to juice and to freeze that much of it and mix it with a heavy cream.
And you didn't just fly him over, one day?
No. I mean, the technology alone. And, his moniker is that he's the king of chefs and the chef of kings. And that comes from Kaiser Wilhelm with 140 other German dignitaries eating a couple of great meals on essentially the Kaiser's ocean liner. And then asking to speak to the chef the next morning and Escoffier turning up and him saying, I'm the emperor of Germany. You're the emperor of chefs. And, of course, the press grabbed onto that. And he still
is the king of chefs. He still is noted as the greatest chef ever.
So Obviously, anyone who attends this is going to get a wonderful meal. But what do you hope the takeaway is beyond that? I mean, do you hope that people are become more interested in Escoffier and where the history of this kind of dining comes from? Or is it really you just want to pay homage yourself?
It's both, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, I would love for people to be educated about where all the food comes from. And I think that it's important also for cooks these days to know where food comes from. Most cooks enter a kitchen and don't really know anything about the food. You know, they don't know the tradition behind it. They don't know the makings behind it or why this dish exists. And it's just very interesting to dive into that and to find out about it. It's basically a history lesson.
I mean, for me, you know, when Escoffier was cooking in his uncle's restaurant in Nice, 300 years earlier, Catherine de' Medici had come over and brought all of those great cooks and chefs and recipes essentially to the French. And that changed food history. And then we have Carême, and then we have Escoffier, then we have Paul Bocuse, and you know, and then the tradition carries on here in America and throughout Europe. And so when I dive in or tuck into a dish, knowing all those dimensions, and that it isn't just a random experience that the chef thought would be tasty, but it's part of my history, all of our history, that's what I'm hoping people pass through their minds as they're taking that bite.
Well, you know, now I need to have lunch because I'm hungry. Just thinking
every
about
every time
it.
With our segments,
every
Bonnie.
Time, every time.
But we can go get some French food up at Lake Park Bistro.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Adam and Kyle, it is a pleasure. Thank you so much for stopping by, and best of luck.
Thank you very much for having us.
Delighted.
Adam Siegel is executive chef at Bartolotta's Lake Park Bistro restaurant. Kyle Cherik is host of Public Television's Wisconsin Foodie and a Lake Effect contributor. They talked with Bonnie North about tomorrow evening's Escoffier dinner, which is sold out and currently only accepting waitlist reservations. Even so, you can learn more about it from a link at WUWM.com. Speaking of food, this month marks the Food Lover's Guide issue of Milwaukee Magazine. We will get a taste of what's inside when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. This month's Milwaukee Magazine is billed as the Food Lover's Guide, or the Epicure's Guide to Milwaukee. But if you think that means a list of great restaurants, you are very much mistaken. It is a guide to all things food-related, such as preserving food, top tools, raising animals, and even knife lessons. Dining critic, senior editor, and Lake Effect contributor Ann Christensen edited the section. She was a bit under the weather, and so she joined Lake Effect's Dan Harmon by phone and gave us the backstory of this year's edition of the guide.
2 years ago, we did a Food Lover's Guide, but it was more focused on cheeses, sausages, artisan bakery, breads, things of that nature. And we wanted to revisit that, but in a different way. And when I sat down with my editor, what he wanted was something that would appeal to someone who, you know, likes to shop at Sur La Table and watches the Food Network. Those were his two parameters. And so I thought, well, okay, that's awfully broad. What are we going to do here? So after a lot of brainstorming sessions, we ended up putting together something which I think will appeal to someone who is not much of a cook and wants to be, and hopefully maybe somebody who's a little more advanced and maybe wants to learn some things or be entertained or, you know, just find something interesting to read.
Right. And as someone that cooks, I mean, to me, half the fun, well, it's fun to cook, but a lot of it is reading about food or actually going out and shopping for food or all the gadgets and things that you use to cook. I mean, this is all fun stuff. So a lot of that is in here. And you do have some actual food-related things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you want to, you know, if you wanted to invest in some cookbooks that chefs use for inspiration, they're going to be in here. If you would like to improve your knife holding skills in the kitchen, you can learn how to do that too. How to pick out knives, how to clean them. We cover that. So, I mean, it really, you know, there's tons of, if you have children and you're trying to figure out, how do I get my kid to be, you know, a kid that actually eats foie gras or Brussels sprouts, something like this. I mean, a lot of kids just won't, but we talked to some experts who say if you include kids in cooking and in food choices, they're going to be more likely to try things that are new. That may or may not work. I would say that hasn't worked. I don't have kids, but the kids that I know, that hasn't necessarily worked for them, but it's worth a shot.
Yeah.
So it really covers people that have, you know, very different interests in terms of food.
Yeah, there are quite a few of them, yeah. Something that always occurs to me when I see this, I call it a map, but a diagram, but the cow map, the cow diagram that shows you
right.
what cuts of meat come from what part of the animal. I think that's really interesting, and I wonder how many people actually know where their favorite cuts of meat are on the cow.
That's a really good question. I was showing, when I decided I wanted to do this, I was showing maps to people in my office, and a lot of them didn't know. I mean, they said, well, wait a minute. Where does a filet mignon come from? Where does brisket come from? You know, rump roast, okay, that makes a little bit more sense. Okay, you're going in the back in the rump area. Oxtails, well, that's the tail meat of the cow. You know, some of the things are a little more straightforward. But a lot of times you don't know. Corned beef, I mean, where does that come from? So I think it's an interesting diagram. It also gives you a few ideas for what to do with those cuts if you want to buy them and cook them at home.
And related to that, the last part of the article is on raising animals, which I think is interesting, just seeing what communities allow, which animals and regulations, I guess, around what you're able to do.
I mean, I think it's pretty fascinating. I mean, you know, you might be more likely, you know, in the case of pigs, for instance, you have to live in the city of Waukesha, and they're technically okay with it if you can find a location that's 200-plus yards from any residence or public street. Okay, so, I mean, there definitely are areas where you cannot, you know, you're not going to be able to raise pigs in Milwaukee, but, you know, there definitely are places in Milwaukee you can raise chickens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, yeah, I think it's really pretty fascinating, and people are getting more into that. They want to have their own eggs. They want to have their own chickens. They want to raise them, and maybe they just want them for the eggs, and they actually sort of have them as pets. So, yeah, I mean, out in rural Waukesha, that's where you're going to find a lot of the beekeepers, too. So, you know, it's pretty interesting stuff. So, and the same with, what do you need to think about if you want to preserve your own food? Because, I mean, there are a lot of things you need to think about so that it's safe. And I think that's the premise of the piece that we have in the...
And that's a whole other section, right? Yeah.
It's a whole other section in our Epicure's Guide is on preserving food and how to do this safely. So we went to an expert. We went to this woman who's a professor of food science at UW-Madison, pretty much wrote the book on this, and she knows exactly what to do, how canning can be deadly, how to do it safely, you know, different things like pickling, drying food, things of that nature, which to me is really interesting stuff.
All right. And another section, the last section I think we'll have time to talk about is, and of course I like this because I like gadgets, but the top tools for cooking. I think that's really fun.
Yeah, and, you know, for this, I decided I was going to go right to the chef because, you know, a lot of people might think, well, yeah, I really need a can opener, electric can opener. I need I have to have an egg tray or something like that. Well, you know, I kind of went to the chef and I said, okay, if you just could only have 5 gadgets, what would they be? What are the things that you could not live without? That's essentially what that was the premise that I went with. So there are a lot of really great ideas for things that are really practical, and that was the point. It had to be practical things that not a professional chef, just a home cook could learn from as well.
And they all basically said they have one or two pans that they use the most.
Oh, yeah.
And that's it.
One or two pans, or a single knife, one or two knives that they carry with them all the time. They use for multiple applications. But, yeah, the photo, which I think was pretty fun that we were able to do this, the photo in that section, on the tool section, is actually a pan that Chef Dan Van Rijt of Hinterland owns. And he has had this pan for, since he was in 10th grade, and he's now in his 40s, and he continues to use this pan. That's his favorite pan. So, I don't know. I think that's just sort of an interesting... You know, interesting take too. I think some chefs are really they're really practical people, and also if you've got a great tool, stick with it.
And to me, this begs the question, and I don't think that this was discussed in the article, but I'm wondering if you talked about it or talked with chefs about it, which is knowing the difference between what's a trendy gadget, because some people are gadget freaks and they just like to get the latest thing and have fun with it, and then usually it ends up collecting dust somewhere, or what is actually useful. I mean, there are new gadgets that actually prove themselves over time that they, you can't live without them, you know, like a high-speed blender or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a baker, I mean, you have to have some kind of mixer, you know, like a KitchenAid mix or something like that. I didn't really get very deep into that idea of, okay, what are the gadgets that you should really not invest in? Do you really need a rice cooker? Do you really need a sous vide machine? Well, maybe not. I think that would be really fun to revisit that and kind of look at, some of those things that, you know, maybe this really isn't worth your money, you know? Mm.
I mean, I remember getting a little bit of heat, no pun intended, from a friend when I got an egg poacher, and she thought that was just ridiculous because you can just make it in boiling water.
Well, you can. So did you use the egg poacher?
I do.
That would be the question. Oh,
I do.
Well, okay. Well, then it works for you.
And I tried it on the water, and it just make a big mess. So for me, it's worth it.
Okay. Well, there you go. There you go.
All right, and thanks for coming in, Anne.
Thanks.
Anne Christensen is senior editor and dining critic at Milwaukee Magazine and a regular Lake Effect contributor. She spoke with Dan Harmon about the Epicure's Guide to Milwaukee. It's in the magazine's March issue, and you'll find a link from WUWM.com. That's Thursday's edition of the program. I'm Mitch Teich. It's so great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Keep listening. Fresh air comes your way next.